Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, April 25. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette, "Stay tuned" is the caption for a photo. And it says, "Work is underway to restore transmissions to Linn County weather radios. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration weather radio transmitter near Kirkwood Community College in southwest Cedar Rapids has been offline since April 13. Replacement parts, including cables and a new antenna, are being installed on the tower this week to bring it back online. The transmitter sends reports to weather radios throughout Linn County." And the photo shows tower technicians Kyler Goldbraugh and Josh Fitzler as they prepare to replace parts on the weather radio transmitter Wednesday. Tower technicians Kyler Goldbraugh and Lucas Fisher and Josh Fitzler also are shown as they prepare to replace cables and an antenna. Also on the front page, Cedar Rapids awards incentives for $21 million commercial park near the airport. This story by Marissa Payne. Cedar Rapids City Council this week awarded incentives to a developer to build a $21 million airport commercial park in southwest Cedar Rapids that would bring new warehouses online in a part of town where industrial development is booming. The proposal includes construction of 5 commercial lots along Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest, as proposed by Iowa Development 1, LLC, near the Eastern Iowa Airport. This project is on 15 acres, generally south of the Iowa National Guard, and will include a mix of warehouse buildings, contractor suites, and self-storage units. The project calls for construction on 15 acres, the minimum acreage to be eligible for incentives under the city's Master Plan Redevelopment Economic Development Program. One warehouse would be 20,000 square feet, while another one would be 24,000 square feet. There would be 4 13,000-square-foot contractor suite buildings. It includes self-storage units for some of the contractor suite buildings and serves as a small business incubator, City Economic Development Coordinator Scott Mather said. The development would retain 40 jobs and create 40 new ones under terms approved by the City Council. The jobs retained are based on interactions with existing smaller businesses. They'd be able to retain 40 jobs moving to this location and expanding their businesses, Mather said. The new jobs are based on the developer's negotiations with companies outside the state. The city would provide a 10-year, 50% rebate of increased taxes generated by the project. Based on the investment and estimated post-development value, city staff estimates the project would generate $3.6 million in total taxes over a 10-year period, of which $1.4 million would be rebated back to the company. Council member Scott Olson said he was aware of developers who had asked for incentives in this area for spec buildings without a company tied to them, but they didn't receive the incentives. "We're seeing these flex buildings being built all over the city and a lot by the airport of different sizes," Olson said. "I'm trying to think, what's that fine line where we go with incentives or not incentives?" Mather said he wasn't aware of those projects specifically, but this project was eligible because it met the city's 15-acre minimum. An entity of Corridor Construction Network, Stonemeyer LLC, also was awarded incentives to expand its operations with a new commercial building at 1265 Wilson Avenue Southwest. Corridor Network Construction has had headquarters in Cedar Rapids since 2015 and is looking to expand with a $5.4 million capital investment that would keep 70 jobs and create 20 new ones. The proposed project involves construction of a 50,000-square-foot commercial building, a 42,000-square-foot warehouse space, and an 8,000-square-foot office space. Under the city's community benefit incentives, the city would give a 10-year, 50% rebate of increased taxes generated by the project. Based on the investment and estimated post-development value, staff estimates the project would generate $1.6 million in total taxes over a 10-year period, of which $640,000 would be rebated back to the company. The council unanimously approved incentives, but Olson recused himself from voting. Olson, a semi-retired real estate broker, is no longer involved with the property, but he assisted with the developer's purchase of the land 2 or 3 years ago. Development agreements for both projects are slated to come before the council in June. Turning to the Iowa Today page, learn about renters' rights through free workshop today, this story by Marissa Payne. Renters can learn about their rights as tenants through a free workshop being held today featuring local experts. The workshop will be held at Beams Auditorium in the downtown Cedar Rapids Public Library, 450 Fifth Avenue Southeast, according to a news release. The Renters' Rights and Responsibilities workshop begins at 5 p.m. with a 45-minute presentation by Iowa Legal Aid, followed by a question and answer period. The workshop will end by 7 p.m. The workshop is free to all area residents. It is sponsored by the Oak Hill Jackson Neighborhood Association. Oak Hill Jackson has an exceptionally high percentage of residents who are renting the home they live in, whether that be an apartment or single family home, said Dorothy D'Souza Guedes, president of Oak Hill Jackson Neighborhood Association. The neighborhood's homeownership rate is only 24.1%, compared to 74.5% for all of Linn County, she said. As advocates for the neighborhood's residents, it's important for the association to do what we can to make sure renters know how to protect themselves from bad landlords, but also how to be good tenants, D'Souza Guedes said. Topics will include a summary of landlord and tenant law, how to ask a landlord to make repairs, evictions, the multi-county coordinated entry system for residents experiencing homelessness or a housing crisis, Section 8 and other forms of rental assistance, renters insurance, and housing discrimination. Presenters include Lisa Gavin, managing attorney, Iowa Legal Aid, Jennifer Tibbetts, civil rights investigator, Cedar Rapids Civil Rights Commission, Janae Peterman, Director of Housing Services, Waypoint Services, Sarah Buck, Housing Services Manager, City of Cedar Rapids Housing. Cases accounted for 43% of all filed with the Cedar Rapids Civil Rights Commission last year. This shows tenants need more information about their rights as renters, D'Souza Guedes said. And an informed renter should make a better tenant. She encouraged landlords to share workshop information with their tenants. Also on the Iowa Today page, Lee County emergency worker sanctioned for denying CPR to a patient who later died. This by Clark Kaufman from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A Lee County emergency medical technician has been issued a warning by the state for failure to administer CPR to a patient who subsequently died. According to records of the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services, on January 26th, EMT Heather Fraze of Lee County Emergency Medical Services responded to a 911 call for a patient who was in cardiac arrest. The department alleges that Fraze of Donaldson failed to initiate cardiopulmonary resuscitation on her arrival, failed to provide treatment for an irregular heartbeat, and failed to contact online medical direction to terminate resuscitation. According to Lee County EMS Director Mark Long, the patient did not survive. He said Fraze's employment with the service ended a short time later. Health and Human Services Bureau of Emergency Medical and Trauma Services charged Fraze with violating rules related to negligence in performing emergency medical care. Deviations from the standards of skill applied to Iowa emergency medical care providers, failure to exercise the degree of care ordinarily exercised by the average EMS provider, and failure to conform to the minimal standard of practice. As a result, the department issued Fraze a warning and required her to complete a class in advanced cardiovascular life support and take 3 hours of instruction on interpreting EKGs, plus 3 hours of education in professional ethics. According to state records, she has been an EMS provider for at least 20 years. Lee County EMS operates out of stations in Donelson, Fort Madison, and Keokuk, and responds to roughly 5,900 emergency calls per year. In an unrelated matter, the Bureau of Emergency Medical and Trauma Services find the Wadena, Illyria First Responders and EMS service program in Fayette County for repeatedly failing to report data on the services it provides as required by Iowa law. The Bureau notified the program that it was late in reporting data or had reported no data at all on five occasions in 2023, and a letter of warning was sent in December 2023. The Bureau imposed a $250 fine. And an Iowa man has been sentenced to 27 years after a heroin death, this story by Trish Mahaffey. An Iowa City man has been sentenced to 27 years in federal prison for distributing a mixture of a controlled substance that included heroin to a man who overdosed on it and died in January 2021. Dion Mobley, 43, known as Flea, according to court documents, was convicted in a bench or non-jury trial last year of conspiracy to distribute a mixture and substance containing a detectable amount of heroin, resulting in death. Mobley was one of the sources of the heroin that resulted in the death of a man identified in court records only by the initials M.W., January 3, 2021. On Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Stephen Locker sentenced Mobley to 27 years and ordered him to serve 5 years of supervised release following his prison term. Another man, Eugene Shipp, 43, also part of the drug distribution, was convicted in the bench trial. Shipp previously was sentenced to 25 years. According to court documents, the Iowa City and University of Iowa police officers and Johnson County Drug Task Force members conducted surveillance and used cell phone records, social media, and doorbell surveillance video, as well as cooperating witnesses during the investigation, which began in 2019 before the death. Law enforcement started receiving information in late 2019 and early 2020 that Mobley was working with another male, later identified as Shipp, court documents stated. On January 23, 2021, officers responded to an Iowa City home after a landlord found a body there. Joshua Lorkin, the landlord, told police a tenant contacted him about a smell coming from a bedroom, according to court documents. Lorkin found M.W. lying face down on the bed. Officers said the man likely had been dead for some time. They found several syringes near the body and also found a cell phone under his stomach. On a table, there was a plastic bag containing a small amount of what tested as heroin and fentanyl, court records stated. An autopsy showed M.W. died from heroin intoxication. Investigators reviewing M.W.'s phone found his last outgoing call was around 3:16 p.m. January 3, 2021, according to court documents. Based on that call, as well as the body's decomposition and other evidence, police believe he died on or about January 3. The victim's phone also contained messages indicating he received and used the heroin that day, court documents stated. Investigators also found a Facebook Messenger conversation with Cammy Kinzebach, who was known to police as a drug dealer, about M.W. asking her to trade some heroin for prescription medication. M.W. and Kinzebach met on January 3, 2021. M.W. sent her a message about 1:06 p.m. thanking her for the heroin, and she responded about 2 p.m. M.W. then sent a text to another person about 13 minutes later saying he was nodding out, going into a semi-conscious or unconscious state from heroin. About an hour and 15 minutes later, M.W. used his phone for the last time, according to records. On February 19, 2021, officers obtained a search warrant of Kinzebach's Iowa City home and seized her cell phone, two bags of methamphetamine, and two bags of heroin mixed with fentanyl. She identified her drug source as Mobley. Kinzebach told officers Mobley worked with Shipp and she purchased heroin from Mobley about two times a week. She also admitted to selling heroin to M.W. and that it came from Mobley. Kinzebach told or gave police consent to obtain videos from her doorbell camera, court documents stated, which identified M.W. and Ship. Kinzebach previously pleaded guilty to distribution of a controlled substance relating in death in this case. Also in Iowa Today News, this story by Emily Anderson, Foundation Creating DEI Training for Johnson County's Nonprofits. The Community Foundation of Johnson County is working with the cities of Iowa City and North Liberty to create a diversity, equity, and inclusion training program for nonprofit organizations in the county. We have such a variety of organizations serving the same clients. Someone who's coming into the food pantry might also be receiving support in finding housing, support in workforce training, said Ellie Moore, the foundation's vice president for community impact and outreach. So doing a training where everyone has common language and is on the same page about what that needs to look like moving forward feels like a good place to start. The idea for the training came from a grant application cycle the foundation held last fall. The foundation has an inclusive Johnson County fund, which anyone can donate to, that is used to aid projects related to equity and inclusion in the nonprofit sector. The foundation invited organizations to send in applications for funding. Several organizations sought funding to create diversity, equity, and inclusion training, either for staff, board members, or volunteers. Rather than give out a bunch of $1,000 grants so everyone could do their own insular trainings, we thought, we'll grant some other projects. We ended up making 8 grants at about $20,000, and then hold off on those DEI applications for training. The foundation reached out to Iowa City and North Liberty in order to pool resources and start to design a training that could be shared among the organizations that had applied for training funds. Moore said the foundation felt it especially needed the help of experts in the Iowa City Office of Equity and Human Rights. We knew we needed to call on the cities because they have content experts. Iowa City delivers a lot of trainings around equity and access for a lot of different types of providers or people, Moore said. As part of the process of designing the training, the foundation has reached out to various nonprofits in Johnson County and asked them to fill out a survey about their interest in the training. The survey asked organizations to identify what they would like to get out of such a training and what formats they would prefer to see. Moore said the training likely will be 3 or 4 session series later this year and could become an annual training depending on the response. She said she anticipates about 30 organizations will participate in the initial training this year. My assumption is, at the very least, we'll have some common language around how we talk about equity, inclusion, and access. We'll have some cultural competency pieces built in that are very broad and make sense for everyone to learn about, Moore said. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial is from the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and it appeared in Tuesday's edition. The title, Court Smacks Down California on Property Rights. Property rights are an inalienable right and a fundamental part of this nation's political tradition, yet they face ongoing attacks from government busybodies. This month, a unanimous Supreme Court ruled legislative governments can't impose excessive fees on property owners looking to build on their own land. The ruling in Sheets v. County of El Dorado, California, is a welcome limitation to the tentacles of government. The case began in 2016 when George Sheets sought to build a single-family home. He owned property in California's El Dorado County. County officials there told him he had to pay $23,420 for traffic impact mitigation before he would be allowed to build. Public officials involved were oblivious to the clear conflict with the Fifth Amendment's Takings Clause, which prohibits the government from taking private property for public use without just compensation. Sheets paid the fee to obtain the permit, but did so under protest. He argued that any assessed traffic fee should be based on the need to mitigate traffic from his specific project. In what's called the Nolan-Dolan test, the Supreme Court had previously ruled that permit conditions need to have an essential nexus to the government's land use requirements. In other words, the government can't extort money from property owners by holding up their permits. Further, any fees must be generally proportioned to the public burden added by the project. State courts rejected that argument. They believed the excessive fee was constitutional because the County Board of Supervisors had enacted it through the legislative process. In its ruling, the High Court dismissed that logic. A legislative exception to the Nolan-Dolan test conflicts with the rest of our takings jurisprudence, which does not otherwise distinguish between legislation and other official acts, Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote in for the court. Further, nothing in constitutional text, history, or precedent supports exempting legislatures from ordinary taking rules, she wrote. It is significant that the court was united in its decision. The legislative branch cannot exempt itself from constitutional protections it finds inconvenient. Not even in California. The court's ruling is a victory for property rights and common sense. 24-Hour Doorman today is titled, Legislature's Buzzer Beater, an Airball. While Iowa lawmakers were burning the midnight oil early Saturday in a push to adjourn the 2024 session, an extension of a moratorium on new gambling licenses went up in smoke. So, what happened? Well, in those late hours, the legislature moves in mysterious ways. And, according to folks I've talked to who were there, it is likely a confluence of factors that scuttled a bill. One big factor is Cedar Rapids casino backers were not blindsided, as they were in 2022 when the legislature approved a 2-year moratorium. This time, the Cedar Rapids Development Group had an 8-person lobbying firm at its disposal, watching for all signs of trouble. One of those lobbyists is former Senate Majority Leader Bill Dix, who left the Senate, abruptly, in March 2018. He still had enough juice with his former colleagues to help head the bill off at the pass. Relationships are always, that's how the legislature works, Dix said in a brief interview. He said he was tempted to tell me what happened, but declined. I don't think that's my role. Lobbyists, as an unwritten rule, avoid talking on the record. On the other side, 6 lobbyists for Elite Casinos and Resorts lobbied for the bill. Elite is led by Dan Kell and owns 5 casino properties in Iowa, Nebraska, and Illinois. That includes Riverside Casino and Golf Resort, which would likely lose business to a Cedar Rapids casino. Kell was not content with just a 5-year extension of the moratorium to 2029. He attempted to nuke Cedar Rapids' casino dreams once and for all. The amendment extending the moratorium, sponsored by Representative Bobby Kaufman, a Republican from Wilton, also prohibited the future licensing of any casino that would negatively impact a casino in a rural county with a population of less than 30,000. Consequently, if market studies show a Cedar Rapids facility would cannibalize revenues from Riverside, it would be illegal to grant them a license even after 2029. With that, Kell may have overplayed his hand. Some lawmakers want competition. Then it was sent to the Senate, but it wasn't received until after 1 a.m. The Senate conducted some business and stood at ease at 2:42 a.m., according to the Senate Journal, and reconvened at 3:25 a.m. A few minutes later, the Senate passed a resolution adjourning for the year. Game over. Sometimes when you commence a legislative sneak attack under cover of darkness, the clock might run out. This buzzer beater was an airball. So, now Cedar Rapids is on its way to joining the casino cartel, right? Backers will receive green jackets, sort of like the masters, but the color of money. Well, not exactly. Now the tough part begins. Convincing the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission to approve a license for a Cedar Rapids gambling parlor. This will be the 3rd attempt to win a license, with proposals voted down in 2013 and 2017. In both cases, the dreaded cannibalization of bucks from existing casinos proved decisive. Will it happen again? Probably. Iowa's gambling market is pretty well saturated, but I thought the moratorium would pass again. So, what do I know? One community letter today titled "Legislature Claims Victory in Meat Culture Wars." As the menace of lab-grown meat looms on the horizon, the legislature has rushed to blunt its potential assent with a bill introducing strict labeling requirements. That'll show 'em. Newsflash. Many people I have talked to are thrilled about the prospect, being sick of the excesses of industrial agriculture. So, labor away. They will thank you. I wrote that the term lab-grown meat substitute routinely appears when, in fact, the product is, genetically speaking, meat. How about some truth in labeling here? As to its emerging technology status, all such products require FDA approval. So much for jeopardizing our children, as the protectionist provisions in this bill would apply. And as for its petri dish origins, I believe such lab equipment supplies the birthplace for the IVF embryos, whose eternal preservation is of such concern. I don't hear them referenced as people substitutes. One senator's lament seems to be that real lamb, goats, chickens will no longer have the opportunity to frolic in the meadow. There's very limited time for lambs being lambs at all. So, petri dishes, sanitary production facilities, and cleaner water, or captive bolt guns, CAFOs, fecal soup, and child labor. Up to you. That letter is signed today by Cindy Thompson Adhikari from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS. Today is Thursday, April 25. Now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First from Hiawatha, Richard Brewer, 91, died Wednesday, April 24. Murdoch Funeral and Cremation Services. In Decorah, Laverne Franzen, 94, died Tuesday, April 23. The Helms Funeral Home is handling arrangements. In Allwine, James A. Larson, 72, died Monday, April 22nd. Jameson Schmidt's funeral home. In Volga, Janice Elaine Moore, 78, died Friday, April 19. Leonard Groff Funeral Home and Cremation Service, El Cader. From Vinton, Ernest, known as Ernie D. Riggle, 86, died Tuesday, April 23. Van Steenhuis Tien Funeral Home. And in Vinton, Linda Rouse, age 77, died Wednesday, April 24. Van Steenhuis Tien Funeral Home. And in Waterloo, Mac H. Estep, 77, died April 21st. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Allwine. Turning now to the services, first in Burlington, Joanne Marie Jagerson Foster, age 70, died on April 23 at Southeast Iowa Regional Hospice House. She was born August 1, 1953 in Cedar Rapids and was the daughter of Thomas Ken and Betty Jo Cannon. Joanna worked for Shearer's for 27 years and was a huge Elvis Presley fan. During football season, she was either watching the Denver Broncos or the Iowa Hawkeyes. Her life was her family. Whenever one of the grandchildren was playing at a sport event, you could always find Joanna on the sideline, cheering them on. Most of all, Joanna loved being with her family. Per her wishes, cremation has been accorded and entrusted to the care of Lunning Chapel. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Online condolences can be made by visiting lunningfuneralchapel.com. From Newport Richey, Florida, Juliana K. Robinson Stadelman Atio, age 85, passed away in Newport Richey. Juliana was born September 14, 1938, the daughter of Earl and Geraldine Robinson Stadelman. She graduated from high school in Jackson, Michigan with the class of 1957. Following school, she worked for a local bank where she saved enough money to buy a sewing machine. She trained herself to sew and became a wonderful seamstress. Juliana later became a secretary for Jackson Flying Service. Working for the Flying Service, She met Arlo Attio, and they were married in the early 60s. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at Oak Hill Cemetery in Norway, with Pastor Tim Ferry officiating. Memorials may be made to Oak Hill Cemetery, Norway, at Bank, Iowa. Online condolences can be made at newhousefuneralservice.com. From Marion, Joe Rosenberger, 88, passed away Friday, April 19th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, April 29, at the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection, with visitation 1 hour prior. The interment will be at a later date at Martin Creek Cemetery. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Joe was born on June 8, 1935 in Calhoun County, Iowa, the son of Clarence Ellsworth and Anna Laura Musburger Rosenberger. He graduated from Lytton High School and went on to attend the University of Iowa. Memorials are suggested in Joe's memory to the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection or the Eastern Iowa Honor Flights. Please share a memory of Joe at murdochfuneralhome.com. From Port Hueneme, California, Randall, known as Randy Martins, age 66, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, March 22nd. Cremation will be performed in California. Randall is survived by three children, Teresa, Anne Marie, and Mark. He graduated from Jefferson High School in 1976, born November 7, 1957 in Cedar Rapids to Lloyd and Alice Williamson Martins. He attended Kirkwood Community College for 1 year. In Iowa City, Dr. Teresa Finken. On Friday, April 12, Dr. Teresa Finken passed away peacefully at her home in Iowa City. A celebration of life open house will be held at the Heights Rooftop in Iowa City, June 8, from 2 to 5 p.m. Instead of flowers, please send a donation to Tapestry Farms, a local nonprofit Teresa donated her time and resources to. Teresa was born in Baltimore in 1951, the first of six siblings. She was a teacher most of her life, beginning as the oldest sibling, then started her career student teaching grades 1 through 8 in a multi-age program in 1972. Teresa moved to Iowa City in 1977. She taught junior high math in nearby Solon for 19 years and obtained her Ph.D. in math education from the University of Iowa in 2002. She was a professor at the University of Iowa, Central College, and Iowa Wesleyan University. From Winnebago, Minnesota, Bob Sturtz, age 71, passed away April 19. He was born on April 11, 1953 in Sioux City, Iowa. Bob was a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and friend to many. Bob had a fulfilling career starting as a rural letter carrier in 1980, and in 1981 he began working with the Postal Union as a local steward, and later served on the Minnesota State Union Board as vice president and president. Visitation will be held at Spencer Owen Funeral Home in Winnebago, Minnesota, Sunday, April 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. To honor and celebrate Bob's life, a private celebration of life will take place at a later date. From Summerfield, North Carolina, Phyllis Luetta Teen, age 85, formerly of Edgewood, Iowa, passed away peacefully at home with family by her side on February 5 after a long illness. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at the Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester, visitation 1 hour prior to the service. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Phyllis, starting at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 27th. Interment will follow at the Edgewood Cemetery in Edgewood, Iowa. Please share a memory at murdochfuneralhome.com. In Cedar Rapids, Patty Lou DeSelm Heemstra, age 89, passed away at her home in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, April 23rd. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel Stateroom Friday, April 26th from 5 to 7 p.m. A funeral service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories on Saturday, April 27th at 3 p.m. with the certified celebrant Randy Walton officiating. Interment to follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of Serenity. Patty was born January 14, 1935 in Oskaloosa, Iowa. She was the daughter of the late Warren and Mildred Beach DeSelm. On June 14, 1953, Patty married the love of her life, Roland Heemstra, in Oskaloosa, Iowa. Memorials are suggested in her name to the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. And lastly, from Prairieburg, Nelson Frank LeClaire, 90, passed away on Tuesday, April 23rd, surrounded by loved ones at his home. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, April 28th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m., Monday, April 29th, at St. Joseph Catholic Church, 300 West Avenue in Prairieburg, where an additional visitation will take place for 1 hour prior to the Mass. Burial with military honors will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery in Prairieburg. Nelson was born May 23, 1933, in Delaware County, Iowa, the son of Ray and Minerva Ratcliffe LeClaire. He served in the United States Army during the Korean conflict from 1953 to 1955. Memorials in his memory are suggested to Camp Courageous. Please share a memory of Nelson at murdockfuneralhome.com. Turning now to the sports page, One More Dash of Glory is the title on this front page article, and the stories by Jeff Linder. Baylor Spiedel wishes the tale had a more heroic slant. There was no mad dash out of a burning building, no diving save of a neighbor's cat that had tumbled from a tree. Spiedel suffered a fractured fibula in his right leg last fall during football season. He could have left it at that. But there's more to the story. Well, it didn't exactly happen in a football game, he said, somewhat sheepishly. It was week six. Homecoming week at Lisbon High School. One of the pep rally activities was a game of musical chairs. We were down to the last two, Gabe and me, Spiedel said. The music stopped. He and Holub collided. He was in pain but underestimated the extent of the injury. He played that Friday night, rushing seven times for 74 yards and two touchdowns in the Lions' 68-0 rout of Wapello. The pain persisted and then worsened the next week at practice. We laughed about it at first, said Lonnie, Baylor's father and track coach. Once we saw the x-ray, we weren't laughing anymore. The right fibula was shattered. Spiedel's football season was over. Surgery was recommended, but I knew it would lengthen my recovery time, he said. We put it in the boot and took a lot of calcium supplements. In the 6 months since, Spiedel has healed up nicely, according to his father. He was really patient. He took his nutrition and his supplements seriously. He wasn't going to push himself too hard, too early. This weekend, Spiedel will realize how far back he has come. A Class 1A power, Lisbon will take a good share of boys' events to the Drake Relays, which runs today through Saturday at Drake Stadium in Des Moines. Spiedel was the third-place finisher in the Drake 100-meter dash last year. He returns in that event. He is seated 13th with a season best of 10.83 seconds, as well as the 400-meter relay, and the Lions are ranked 30th at 43.52 seconds. The finals are definitely a goal in the 100, he said. A white flag would be the ultimate. He comes from speedy genetics. Both of his parents were track athletes. Lonnie was a long sprinter in Illinois, and Carrie Kosher Spiedel was a member of Iowa City West's state champion shuttle hurdle relay team in 1999. Baylor is 5'9" and 170 pounds. Not this insane physical specimen, he called himself, but off-season work pays off, staying consistent. I'm picky about my diet, what I put in my body, no processed foods. Lonnie recalls an instance of some fatherly teasing when Baylor was 10 years old. I was giving him a hard time about his knobby knees, he said. Baylor said, these knobby knees are going to win state someday. At Lisbon, Spiedel had the opportunity to blossom. The Lions have won four 1A team titles since 2015, and their 2017 squad owns the small school record for points in a state meet at 89. We have a very determined set of individuals, Baylor said. Once you get a taste of winning, you want it to continue. The Lions returned to the top in 2023, scoring 60 points at the state meet and outscoring runner-up Columbus Community by 8. Spiedel overcame a false start disqualification in the 200 meters, running on the Lions' title quartet in the 400-meter relay. He was the runner-up in the 100 and the 800 relay. I had never DQ'd in a race before, he said. I felt we got held in the blocks, and for some reason I twitched. It happened. I felt an extreme amount of guilt. Thankfully, it didn't come down to those points that we lost. Lonnie was in the Drake Stadium infield getting ready to talk to a shot putter when it happened. We had a chance to talk afterward, Lonnie said. I said, you still have plenty of events to go. I love you, and we still need you. During practice Monday, Baylor wore a white Nike t-shirt on a tortoise with the words, white Nike t-shirt of a tortoise with the words, in all capital letters, I am speed. He talked about his post-Lisbon plans. I was thinking Indian Hills Community College, maybe, but that has kind of changed. I'm planning on Mount Mercy University now, but my dream is to compete for Iowa. He talked about another dream title, team title. We want that points record too, he said. But he understands that in a world of musical chairs mishaps and starting block twitches, stuff sometimes happens. Nothing is ever promised, he said. In the Drake relays, here are five Iowa High School things to watch. This by Jeff Linder. Keep an eye on the sky Friday. Five things to watch in the high school portion of the Drake Relays, which runs today through Saturday at the Drake Stadium. Four different area boys from four different area schools are seated number one in four different events. Solon's Ben Kempman leads the discus field at 188 feet, 4.5 inches. Cedar Rapids Prairie's T.Y. Poor is tops in the long jump, 23 feet, 1 inch. Iowa City West's Aiden Jacobson is the favorite in the 400-meter hurdles at 52.52 seconds. South Tama's Tommy Tinisma has run a state-leading 1:54.12 in the 800 meters. Western Dubuque owns the top-seeded boys' shuttle hurdle relay. The Bobcats have run 59.23 seconds. If an area girls' champion arises, it's most likely to come in a field event. Linmar's Abby Mecklenburg is seated second in the long jump. HLV's Emma Roberts is number two in the high jump. Ankeny High School enjoys an embarrassment of riches in boys' sprinting. The Hawks have two of the top three times in the 100 meters and are ranked 1-2-3 in the 200. No wonder they already have posted an all-time Iowa best in the 800-meter relay, 1:26.12, on April 9. They'll also pursue the Iowa all-time record in the 400-meter relay, 41:33, this weekend. They have run 41:76 this season. There's a good a good chance that the star of the weekend won't hail from a big city school. Clear Lake Junior Reese Brownlee is the top seed in three girls' events, the 400 meters at 56.6 seconds, 400-meter hurdles, 1:01.95, and the long jump at 19 feet, 1/4 inch. Only one Iowa girl, the great Debbie Esser of Woodbine, has broken the 60-second barrier in the 400 hurdles, and that was in 1975. At 57.3. Three high-profile juniors have transferred and each make their new teams quite a bit stronger. Annie Wiedemeyer, formerly of Iowa City High, helps to fortify the Pleasant Valley girls' middle distance events, while Noelle Steins, She led Calamus Wheatland to the Class 1A state title last year, does the same this year for Tipton. Logan Fairchild was a sprint star at Winterset and now is part of Ankeny's speedy crew. It's going to be warmer than usual, but Friday could be a problem. The Friday forecast calls for wind 20 to 30 miles an hour out of the southeast and a virtual 100% chance of rain with the potential for severe thunderstorms. High temperatures are expected to be in the 70s all 3 days. And in boys soccer, this story by Ryan Plagenkuhl, plenty left on second-ranked West Branch's to-do list. Across the Iowa high school boys soccer landscape, it's hard to argue there's a league more competitive than the River Valley Conference. The RVC is home to Class 1A's top three teams, number one Iowa City Regina, number two West Branch, and number three West Liberty. All three qualified for the Iowa Boys State Tournament in 2023. All three are undefeated in conference play. While these teams share many similarities in terms of recent accomplishments, one distinction separates West Branch historically. They've yet to claim victory against the Regals or the Comets. West Liberty we play every year, and we always get beat by one, said West Branch coach Ted Miller, noting the Bears' varsity program was born in 2018. We've only played Regina once. Consider these tasks among the top priorities on the Bears' 2024 season to-do list. Hopefully, the team will come in those days and be ready to play, Miller said. They're both really good teams. I'm actually excited to play them. To be the best, you have to beat the best. To beat the best, they'll have to do it on the road. West Branch, at 7-0, will travel to Regina on May 6th and West Liberty on May 10 in its regular season finale. Tough challenges, but Miller's team certainly has the firepower to pull off big wins. West Branch's high-octane offense was on full display Monday night at Butch Pettersen Field in the 9-0 rout of Prince of Prince, 2-4, 2-4. Christian Skyer scored 4 goals. Trenton Schulte had 2, and leading scorer Joe Hammond, Braden Sexton, and Reese Gingrich each had 1. I think offensively we're really good, Hammond said. We have a great connection with one another, and it makes communication easy, even without talking. It's instinctive. We know what everyone's going to do because we've played together for so long. West Branch returned its top 5 scorers from last year's state tournament qualifying roster. 3 are seniors. The experience helps tremendously, Miller said. They get along so well. They have so much fun on the field, in practices, on the bus rides. It's a plus. Chemistry helps. An abundance of talent doesn't hurt either. Having a deep bench makes a big difference as well, Miller said. We have quite a few subs that I can put in the game and not have to worry about losing much. The Bears will need all these factors working in their favor to accomplish their season-long goals of not only taking down Regina and West Liberty, but doing damage at state. Let's go all the way with it, Hammond said. Last year we made our first state appearance in the soccer program history. I want to make it further this year. Turning now to the Things to Do page in the educational category, Relief Cedar Rapids Plan. Join Trees Forever staff for an educational presentation that will discuss the Relief Cedar Rapids Plan, provide tips on how to properly plant and care for new trees, and explore the many ways you can get involved in the effort to reforest the city's tree canopy. That takes place at 7 to 8 p.m. tonight, and that is free. In the Hoopla section, the front page, and all that jazz. If You Go, the Broadway National Tour of Chicago is appearing at Hancher Auditorium, 141 East Park Road in Iowa City. The dates of the performance are May 3 to 5 at 7:30 p.m. Friday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Saturday, 2 p.m., let me go over those times again, May 3rd to the 5th, 7:30 p.m. on Friday, 2 and 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, and 2 p.m. on Sunday, with ASL and audio description. Tickets are $79 to $119 for adults, $65 to $119 for students and youth. You can call the Hancher box office at 319-335-1160. Chew on This by Elijah Desius is titled Iowa Pork Producers Searching for the Best Pork Tenderloin from Clive. They found the best pulled pork sandwich earlier this month. Now the Iowa Pork Producers Association is searching for the best breaded pork tenderloin in all the land. The Pork Producers 22nd Annual Best Breaded Pork Tenderloin Contest launched on April 17 and will run through June 3 to allow Iowans to submit their top choice for the best pork tenderloin sandwich in the state. Each Iowan can submit one nomination online at iowapork.org. Iowans love their tenderloin sandwiches, and there is no shortage of restaurants serving up these beloved Iowa staples, said Kelsey Sutter, Marketing and Programs Director for the IPPA. The 2023 competition nearly broke 10,000 nominations, so we're hoping to see great participation and support for Iowa's restaurants again this year. To qualify for the contest, tenderloins must be hand-breaded and part of the regular menu at an Iowa establishment with year-round hours. Food trucks, concession stands, seasonal eateries, and catering businesses are not eligible. After the nomination period, the committee will review the top 40 restaurants. Five establishments with the most nominations from each of the organization's eight districts. Finalist contenders will then be evaluated by a panel of undercover judges on site who will judge each tenderloin based on pork quality, taste, physical characteristics, and overall eating experience. The top five picks will be unveiled in October during National Pork Month. The winning restaurant will receive a $500 cash prize, a plaque to display at their business, and bragging rights to one of Iowa's most quintessential sandwiches. The runner-up will receive $250 and a plaque. Previous Eastern Iowa winners in recent years include 2022 winner Lids Bar and Grill in Waukon, 2020 winner Prairie Moon on Main in Prairieburg, and in 2019 the winner The Pub at the Pinnacon in New Hampton. If nominating isn't enough, earn free merchandise by conquering the IPPA's Tenderloin Trail. Those who eat at 10 of the 14 chosen locations across the state can earn a free t-shirt. For more information, visit iowapork.org/community/contests/tenderloin trails. Finishing up with just a brief look at the weather, increasing clouds today with storms likely tomorrow and Saturday. We're looking for a high in the mid-60s today and reaching that 70 mark by Saturday and Sunday. The normal high for today is 64, the normal low is 41. A record high of 89 degrees was set in 1896, and a record low of 20 was set in 1934. Sunset tonight is at 7:59 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 6:09 a.m. That gives us 13 hours and 49 minutes of daylight. And we're in the full moon phase, with moonrise at 10:14 p.m. and set at 7:18 a.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, April 25. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.